Chapter 21.
"Well, come in, come in."
Carmody blinked. He was no longer exchanging views with the dinosaur in the Cretaceous Age. Now he was somewhere else. He was in a small, dingy room. The floor was of stone, chilly to his feet. The windows were covered with soot. Tall candles trembled uneasily in the draft. A man was seated behind a high roll-top desk. The man had a long nose jutting out of a long, bony face. His eyes were cavernous. There was a brown mole in the middle of his left cheek. His lips were thin and bloodless. The man said,
"I am the Honorable Clyde Beadle Seathright, and you are Mr. Carmody, of course, whom Mr. Maudsley so kindly referred to us. Do take that chair, sir. I trust that your trip from Mr. Maudsley's planet was a pleasant one."
"It was fine," Carmody said, sitting down. He knew he was being ungracious, but the abrupt transitions were beginning to get him down.
"And Mr. Maudsley is well?"
Seathright said, beaming. "He's fine," Carmody said. "Where am I?"
"Didn't the clerk tell you on your way in?"
"I didn't see any clerk. I didn't even see myself come in."
"My, my," Seathright said and clucked mildly. "The reception room must have gone out of phase again. I've had it fixed a dozen times, but it keeps on desynchronizing. It is vexing for my clients, and even worse for my poor clerk who goes out of phase with it and sometimes can't get back to his family for a week or more."
"That is a real tough break," Carmody said, and found himself near hysteria. "If you don't mind," he said, keeping a tight control on his voice, "just tell me what this place is and how I'm supposed to get home from here."
"Calm yourself," Mr. Seathright said. "Perhaps a cup of tea? No? This place, as you refer to it, is the Galactic Placement Bureau. Our articles of incorporation are on the wall, if you would care to read them."
"How did I get here?" Carmody asked. Mr. Seathright smiled and pressed his fingertips together.
"Very simply, sir. When I received Mr. Maudsley's letter, I had a search made. The clerk found you on Earth B3-444-123-C-22. This was obviously the wrong place for you. I mean to say, Mr. Maudsley had done his best, but he is not in the placement service. Therefore, I took the liberty of transporting you here. But if you wish to return to that aforementioned Earth..."
No, Carmody said. I was just wondering how... I mean, you said that this is a Galactic Placement Service, right?"
"The Galactic Placement Service," Seathright corrected gently.
"Okay, so I'm not on Earth."
"No, indeed. Or to put it more rigorously, you are not on any of the possible, probable, potential, or temporal worlds of the Earth configuration."
"Okay, fine," Carmody said. He was breathing heavily. "Now, Mr. Seathright, have you ever been to any of those Earths?"
"I'm afraid I have never had the pleasure. My work keeps me pretty well tied to the office, you see, and I spend holidays at my family's cottage at..."
"Right," Carmody thundered abruptly. "You've never been to Earth, or so you claim. In that case, why in God's name are you sitting in a goddamn room like out of Dickens with candles yet and wearing a stovepipe hat, hey? Let's just hear you answer that one, because I already know the damned answer, which is that some son of a bitch must have drugged me, and I dreamed this whole damned cockamamie thing, including you, you grinning hatchet-faced bastard!" Carmody collapsed in the chair, breathing like a steam engine and glaring triumphantly at Seathright. He waited for everything to dissolve, for funny shapes to come and go, and for himself to wake up in his own bed, in his own apartment, or maybe in a friend's bed, or even in a hospital bed. Nothing happened. Carmody's sense of triumph trickled away. He felt utterly confused, but he was suddenly too tired to care.
"Are you quite over your outburst?" Mr. Seathright asked frigidly.
"Yes, I'm over it," Carmody said. "I'm sorry."
"Don't fret," Seathright said quietly. "You have been under a strain. One appreciates that. But I can do nothing for you unless you keep control of yourself. Intelligence may lead you home. Wild emotional outbursts will get you nowhere."
"I really am sorry," Carmody said. "As for this room, which seems to have startled you so, I had it decorated especially for you. The period is only approximate, the best I could do on short notice. It was done to make you feel at home." That was
Thoughtful of you, Carmody said. I suppose that your appearance?
Yes, precisely,
Mr. Seathright said, smiling. I had myself decorated as well as the room. It was no trouble, really. It is the sort of little touch which so many of our clients appreciate.
I do appreciate it, as a matter of fact, Carmody said. Now that I'm getting used to it, it's sort of restful.
I hoped you would find it soothing, Seathright said.
As for your proposition that all of this is happening to you in a dream, well, it has some merit.
It has.
Mr. Seathright nodded vigorously. It has definite merit as a proposition, but it has no validity as a statement of your circumstances.
Oh, Carmody said, and sat back in the chair.
Strictly speaking, Seathright went on, there is no important difference between imaginary and real events. The opposition you create between them is entirely verbal. You are not dreaming any of this, Mr. Carmody, but I mention that only as a point of incidental information. Even if you were dreaming it at all, you would have to pursue the same course of action.
I don't understand all that, Carmody said, but I'll take your word that this is real.
He hesitated, and then said, But the thing I really don't understand, why is all of this like this? I mean, the Galactic Center looked a little like Radio City, and Borg the dinosaur didn't talk like any dinosaur, even a talking dinosaur ought to talk, and...
Please don't excite yourself, Mr. Seathright said.
Sorry, Carmody said.
You want me to tell you why reality is the way it is, Seathright said. But there is no explanation for that. You must simply learn to fit your preconceptions to what you find. You must not expect reality to adapt itself to you, except very infrequently. It can't be helped if things are strange, and it also can't be helped if things are familiar. Am I getting through?
I think so, Carmody said.
Splendid. You sure you won't have some tea?
No, thank you.
Then we must see about getting you home, Seathright said. Nothing like the dear old place to pick up one's spirits, eh?
Nothing at all, Carmody said. Will it be very difficult, Mr. Seathright?
No, I don't think I would characterize it as difficult, Seathright said. It will be complicated, of course, and rigorous, and even somewhat risky, but I do not consider any of those things to be difficult.
What do you consider truly difficult? Carmody asked.
Solving quadratic equations, Seathright answered at once. I simply cannot do them, even though I have tried a million or more times. That, sir, is a difficulty. Now, let us proceed to your case.
Do you know where Earth is? Carmody asked.
Where poses no problem, Seathright said. You have already been to where, though it didn't do you much good, since when was so far off the mark. But now I think we can pin down your particular when without undue travail. It's the which gets tricky.
Is that likely to stop us?
Not at all, Seathright said. We must simply sort through and find which you belong in. The process is perfectly straightforward, like shooting fish in a barrel, as your people would say.
I've never tried that, Carmody said. Is it really easy?
That depends on the size of the fish and the size of the barrel, Seathright told him. It is, for example, nearly effortless to pot a shark in a bathtub, whereas it is a considerable undertaking to bring down a minnow in a hogshead. Scale is everything.
But whichever project is before you, I think you can appreciate its essential straightforwardness and simplicity.
I suppose so, Carmody said. But it occurs to me that my search for which Earth may be straightforward and simple, but may also be impossible to complete due to the interminability of the series of selections.
That's not quite true. But it's very nicely said, Seathright said, beaming. Complication is often very useful, you know. It helps to specify and identify the problem.
Well, what happens now?
Now we go to work, Seathright said, rubbing his hands together briskly.
My staff and I have put together a selection of which worlds. We confidently expect that your world will be one of them, but of course only you can determine the right one.
So I look them over and decide? Carmody asked.
Something like that, Seathright said. Actually, you must live them over. See, as soon as you are sure, signify to us whether we've hit your probability world or a variant. If it's your world, that's the end of it. If it's a variant, then we move you on to the next which world.
That sounds reasonable enough, Carmody said. Are there a lot of these probability worlds?
An interminable number, as you suspected earlier. But we have every hope of early success, unless...
Unless what?
Unless your predator gets to you first.
My predator?
He is still on your trail, Mr. Seathright said, and as you know by now, he is reasonably adept at setting snares. These snares take the form of scenes culled from your own memories. Terraform scenes, I suppose we could call them, designed to lull and deceive you, to convince you to walk unsuspecting into his mouth.
Will he interfere with your worlds? Carmody asked.
Of course he will, Seathright said. There's no sanctuary in the searching process. On the contrary, the better and more informed the search, the more fraught it is with dangers. You had asked me earlier about dreams and reality. Well, here's your answer. Everything that helps you does so openly. Everything that seeks to harm you does so covertly, by the use of delusions, disguises, and dreams.
Isn't there anything you can do about the predator? Carmody asked.
Nothing. Nor would I if I could. Predation is a necessary circumstance. Even the gods are eventually eaten by fate. You will not be an exception to the universal rule.
I thought you'd say something like that, Carmody said. But can you give me any help at all, any hints on how the worlds you send me to will differ from the worlds of the Predator?
To me the differences are obvious, Seathright said. But you and I do not share the same perceptions. You could not make use of my insights, Carmody, nor I of yours. Still, you have managed to elude the Predator so far.
I've been lucky.
There you are. I have a great deal of skill, but no luck whatsoever. Who can tell which quality will be most needed in the trials ahead? Not I, sir, and certainly not you. Therefore, be of stout heart, Mr. Carmody. Faint heart, ne'er one fair planet, eh? Look over the worlds I send you to. Be extremely cautious of the Predator's scenes of delusion. Get out while the getting's good. But do not be unmanned by fear into passing up your true and rightful world.
What happens if I do pass it by, inadvertently? Carmody asked.
Then your search can never end, Seathright told him. Only you can tell us where you belong. If for one reason or another you do not locate your world among the most likely, then we must continue our search among the merely likely, and then the less likely, and finally the least likely. The number of probability worlds of Earth is not infinite, of course, but from your viewpoint it might as well be. You simply do not have enough inherent duration to search through them all and then begin again.
All right, Carmody said doubtfully. I don't suppose there's any other way.
There's no other way I can help you, Seathright said. And I doubt if there is any way at all that would not involve your active participation. But if you wish, I can make inquiries into alternate galactic location techniques. It would take a while.
I don't think I have a while, Carmody said. I think my predator is not far behind me, Mr. Seathright. Please send me to the probability Earths and also accept my gratitude for your patience and interest.
Thank you, Seathright said, obviously pleased. Let us hope that the very first world will be the one you are seeking.
Seathright pressed a button on his desk. Nothing happened until Carmody blinked. Then things happened very quickly indeed, for Carmody unblinked and saw that he was smack dab on Earth, or on a reasonable facsimile thereof. Part 4. Which is Earth? Chapter 22. Carmody was standing on a neatly trimmed plain beneath a blue sky with a golden-yellow sun overhead. He looked around slowly. Half a mile ahead of him he saw a small city. This city was not constructed in the common manner of an American city, with outliers of gas stations, tentacles of hot dog stands, fringe of motels, and a protective shell of junkyards, but rather as some Italian hill towns are fashioned, and some Swiss villages as well, suddenly rising and brusquely ending, without physical preamble or explanation, the main body of the town presenting itself all at once, and without amelioration. Despite its foreign look, Carmody felt sure he was looking at an American city. So he advanced upon it slowly, and with heightened senses, prepared to flee if anything was amiss. All seemed in order, however. The city had a warm and open look. Its streets were laid out generously, and there was a frankness about the wide bay windows of its storefronts. As he penetrated deeper, Carmody found other delights, for just within the city he entered a piazza, just like a Roman piazza, although much smaller, and in the middle of the piazza there was a fountain, and standing in the fountain was the marble representation of a boy with a dolphin, and from the dolphin's mouth a stream of clear water issued. "I do hope you like it," a voice said from behind Carmody's left shoulder. Carmody did not jump with alarm. He did not even whirl around. He had become accustomed to voices speaking from behind his back. Sometimes it seemed to him that a great many things in the galaxy liked to approach him this way. "It's very nice," Carmody said. "I constructed it and put it there myself," the voice said. "It seemed to me that a fountain, despite the antiquity of the concept, is aesthetically functional, and this piazza, with its benches and shady chestnut trees, is copied from a Bolognese model. Again, I did not inhibit myself with the fear of being old-fashioned. The true artist, it seems to me, uses what he finds necessary, be it 1,000 years old or 1 second new." "I applaud your sentiment," Carmody said. "Permit me to introduce myself. I am Thomas Carmody." He turned, smiling, his hand outstretched. But there was no one behind his left shoulder, or behind his right shoulder either. There was no one in the piazza. Nobody at all in sight. "Forgive me," the voice said. "I didn't mean to startle you. I thought that you knew."
"Knew what?" Carmody said.
"Knew about me."
"Well, I don't," Carmody said. "Who are you, and where are you speaking from?"
"I am the voice of the city," the voice said. "Or, to put it another way, I am the city itself, the veritable city, speaking to you."
"Is that a fact?" Carmody said sardonically.
"Yes," he answered himself. "I suppose it is a fact. So all right. You're a city. Big deal." The fact was, Carmody was annoyed. He had encountered too many entities of great magnitude and miraculous power. He had been one-upped from one end of the galaxy to the other. Forces, creations, and personifications had jumped out at him without cessation, causing him time and time again to lose his cool. Carmody was a reasonable man. He knew there was an interstellar pecking order, and that humans did not rate very high on it. But he was also a proud man. He believed that a man stood for something, if only for himself. A man couldn't very well go around all the time saying, "Oh," and "Ah," and "Bless my soul," to the various inhuman entities that surrounded him. He couldn't do that and keep any self-respect. Carmody cared more than a little for his self-respect. It was, at this point, one of the few things he still possessed. Therefore, Carmody turned away from the fountain and strolled across the piazza like a man who conversed with cities every day of his life, and who is slightly bored with the whole thing. He walked down various streets and up certain avenues. He glanced into store windows and noted the size of houses. He paused in front of statuary, but only briefly.
"Well?" the city said after a while.
"Well, what?" Carmody answered instantly.
"What do you think of me?"
"You're okay," Carmody said.
"Only okay."
"Look," Carmody said, "a city is a city. When you've seen one, you've pretty much seen them all."
"That's untrue," the city said, with some show of pique. "I am distinctly different from other cities. I am unique."
"Are you indeed?" Carmody said scornfully. "To me, you look like a conglomeration of badly assembled parts. You've got an Italian piazza, a couple of Greek-type statues, a row of Tudor houses, an old-style New York tenement, a California hot dog stand shaped like a tugboat, and God knows what else. What's so unique about that?"
"The combination of those forms into a meaningful entity is unique," the city said. "I present variety within a framework of inner consistency. These older forms are not anachronisms, you understand. They are representative styles of living, and as such are appropriate in a well-wrought machine for living."
"That's your opinion," Carmody said. "Do you have a name, by the way?"
"Of course," the city said. "My name is Bellwether. I am an incorporated township in the state of New Jersey. Would you care to have some coffee and perhaps a sandwich or some fresh fruit?"
The coffee sounds good, Carmody said. He allowed the voice of Bellwether to guide him around the corner to an open-air cafe. The cafe was called O.U. Kid and was a replica of a gay 90s saloon, right down to the Tiffany lamps and the cut-glass chandelier and the player piano. Like everything else that Carmody had seen in the city, it was spotlessly clean, but without people.
Nice atmosphere, don't you think? Bellwether asked.
Campy, Carmody pronounced. Okay if you like that sort of thing. A foaming mug of cappuccino was lowered to his table on a stainless steel tray. But at least the service is good, Carmody added. He sipped the coffee.
Good?
Bellwether asked.
Yes, very good.
I rather pride myself on my coffee, Bellwether said quietly, and on my cooking. Wouldn't you like a little something? An omelette, perhaps, or a souffle?
Nothing, Carmody said firmly.
He leaned back in his chair and said, So, you're a model city, huh?
Yes, that is what I have the honor to be, Bellwether said. I am the most recent of all model cities, and I believe the most satisfactory. I was conceived by a joint study group from Yale and the University of Chicago, who were working on a Rockefeller Fellowship. Most of my practical details were devised by MIT, although some special sections of me came from Princeton and from the RAND Corporation. My actual construction was a General Electric project, and the money was procured by grants from the Ford Foundation, as well as several other institutions I am not at liberty to mention.
Interesting sort of history, Carmody said, with unbearable nonchalance.
That's a Gothic cathedral across the street, isn't it?
Yes, completely Gothic, said Bellwether. Also interdenominational and open to all faiths, with a designed seating capacity for 300 people.
That doesn't seem like much for a building that size.
It's not, of course, but my idea was to combine awesomeness with coziness. Many people liked it.
Where are the people, by the way? Carmody asked. I haven't seen any.
They have left, Bellwether said mournfully. They have all departed.
Why? Carmody asked.
Bellwether was silent for a while, then said, There was a breakdown in city-community relations. A misunderstanding, really. Or perhaps I should say, an unfortunate series of misunderstandings. I suspect that rabble-rousers played a part in the exodus.
But what happened precisely?
I don't know, Bellwether said. I really don't know. One day they simply all left, just like that. But I'm sure they'll be back.
I wonder, Carmody said.
I am convinced of it, Bellwether said. But for the nonce, why don't you stay here, Mr. Carmody?
Me? I really don't think.
You appear to be travel-weary, Bellwether said. I'm sure the rest would do you good.
I have been on the move a lot recently, Carmody admitted.
Who knows? You might find that you liked it here, Bellwether said. And in any event, you would have the unique experience of having the most modern, up-to-date city in the world at your service.
That does sound interesting, Carmody said. I'll have to think about it. He was intrigued by the city of Bellwether, but he was also apprehensive. He wished he knew exactly what had happened to the city's occupants.
Chapter 23
At Bellwether's insistence, Carmody went to sleep that night in the sumptuous bridal suite of the King George V Hotel. He awoke in the morning refreshed and grateful. He had been in great need of a cessation of consciousness. Bellwether served him breakfast on the terrace and played a brisk Haydn quartet while Carmody ate. The air was delicious. If Bellwether hadn't told him, Carmody would never have guessed it was filtered. The temperature and humidity were also exquisitely satisfactory. In front of the terrace was a splendid view of Bellwether's western quarter, a pleasing jumble of Chinese pagodas, Venetian footbridges, Japanese canals, a green hill, a Corinthian temple, a parking lot, a Norman tower, and much else besides.
"You have a splendid view," he told the city.
"I'm so glad you appreciate it," Bellwether replied. "Style was a problem that was argued from various positions from the day of my inception. One group held for consistency, a harmonious group of shapes blending into a harmonious whole. But that had been tried before. Quite a few model cities are like that. They are uniformly dull, artificial entities created by one man or one committee, unlike real cities."
"You're sort of artificial yourself, aren't you?" Carmody asked.
"Of course, but I do not pretend to be anything else. I am not a fake city of the future, or a mock Florentine bastard. I am a conglomerate entity. I am supposed to be interesting and stimulating, as well as being functional and practical."
"Bellwether, to me you look okay," Carmody said.
"Do all model cities talk like you?"
"No," Bellwether said. "Most cities up to now, model or otherwise, have never said a word, but their occupants didn't like it. They didn't like a city that did things without saying a word. The city seemed too huge, too masterful, too soulless. That is why I was created with an artificial consciousness."
"I see," Carmody said.
"I wonder if you do. The artificial consciousness personalizes me, which is very important in an age of depersonalization. It enables me to be truly responsive. It permits me to be creative in my reactions to the demands of my occupants. We can reason with each other, my occupants and I. By carrying on in incessant and meaningful dialogue, we can help each other in the creation of a truly viable urban environment. We can modify each other without any significant loss of individuality."
"It sounds fine," Carmody said, "except, of course, that you don't have anyone here to carry on a dialogue with."
"That is the only flaw in the scheme," Bellwether admitted. "But for the present, I have you."
"Yes, you have me," Carmody said, and wondered why the words rang unpleasantly on his ear.
"And naturally, you have me," Bellwether said. "It's a reciprocal relationship, which is the only kind worth having. But now, my dear Carmody, suppose I show you around myself. Then we can get you settled in and regularized."
"And what?"
"I didn't mean it the way it sounded," Bellwether said. "It simply is an unfortunate scientific expression. But you understand, I'm sure, that a reciprocal relationship necessitates obligations on the part of both involved parties. It couldn't very well be otherwise, could it?"
"Not unless it was a laissez-faire relationship."
"We're trying to get away from all that," Bellwether said. "Laissez-faire becomes a doctrine of the emotions, you know, and leads non-stop to anomie. If you will just come this way..." Carmody went where he was told, and beheld the excellencies of Bellwether. He toured the power plant, the water filtration system, the industrial park, and the light industries section. He saw the children's park and the Oddfellows Hall. He walked through a museum and an art gallery, a concert hall, and a theater, and a bowling alley, a billiards parlor, a go-kart track, and a movie theater. He became tired and footsore and wanted to stop, but Bellwether insisted on showing itself off, and Carmody had to look at the 5-story American Express building, the Portuguese synagogue, the statue of Buckminster Fuller, the Greyhound bus station, and several other attractions. At last it was over. Carmody concluded that the wonders of the model city were no better and no worse than the wonders of the galaxy. Beauty was really in the eye of the beholder, except for a small part that was in his feet.
"A little lunch now?" Bellwether asked.
"Fine," Carmody said. He was guided to the fashionable Rochambeau Café, where he began with potage à petits pois and ended with petit four.
"What about a nice Gruyère to finish it off?" Bellwether asked.
"No, thanks," Carmody said. "I'm full. I'm too full, as a matter of fact."
"But cheese isn't filling. A nice camembert?"
"I couldn't possibly."
"Perhaps a few assorted fruits? Very refreshing to the palate?"
"It's not my palate that needs refreshing," Carmody said. At least an apple, a pear, and a couple of grapes? Thanks, no. A couple of cherries? No, no, no. A meal is not complete without a little fruit, Bellwether said. My meal is, Carmody said. There are important vitamins which only fresh fruit can give you. I'll just have to struggle along without them. Perhaps half an orange, which I will peel for you. Citrus fruits have no bulk at all. I couldn't possibly. Not even one quarter of an orange, if I take out all the pits. Most decidedly not. It would make me feel better, Bellwether said. I have a completion compulsion, you know, and no meal is complete without a piece of fruit. No, no, no! All right, don't get so excited, Bellwether said. If you don't like the sort of food I serve, that's up to you. But I do like it. Then if you like it so much, why won't you eat some fruit? Enough, Carmody said. Give me a couple grapes. I wouldn't want to force anything on you. You're not forcing. Give me, please. You're quite sure? Gimme! Carmody shouted. So take, Bellwether said, and produced a magnificent bunch of muscatel grapes. Carmody ate them all. They were very good. Excuse me, Bellwether said. What are you doing? Carmody sat upright and opened his eyes. I was taking a little nap, he said. Is there anything wrong with that? What should be wrong with a perfectly natural thing like that? Bellwether said. Thank you, Carmody said, and closed his eyes again. But why nap in a chair? Bellwether asked. Because I'm in a chair, and I'm already half asleep. You'll get a crick in your back, Bellwether warned him. Don't care, Carmody mumbled, his eyes still closed. Why not take a proper nap over here, on the couch? I'm already napping comfortably where I am. You're not really comfortable, Bellwether pointed out. The human anatomy is not constructed for sleeping sitting up. At the moment, mine is, Carmody said. It's not. Why not try the couch? The chair is fine, but the couch is finer. Just try it, please, Carmody. Carmody? What's that? Carmody said, waking up. The couch. I really think you should rest on the couch. All right, Carmody said, struggling to his feet. Where is this couch? He was guided out of the restaurant, down the street, around the corner, and into a building marked The Snoozery. There were a dozen couches. Carmody went to the nearest. Not that one, Bellwether said. It's got a bad spring. It doesn't matter, Carmody said. I'll sleep around it. That will result in a cramped posture. Christ, Carmody said, getting to his feet. Which would you recommend? This one, back here, Bellwether said. It's king size, the best in the place. The yield point of the mattress has been scientifically determined. The pillows... Right, fine, good, Carmody said, lying down on the indicated couch. Shall I play you some soothing music? Don't bother. Just as you wish. I'll put out the lights then. Fine. Would you like a blanket? I control the temperature here, of course, but sleepers often get a subjective impression of chilliness. It doesn't matter. Leave me alone. All right, Bellwether said. I'm not doing this for myself, you know. Personally, I never sleep. Okay, sorry, Carmody said. That's perfectly all right, Bellwether said. There was a long silence. Then Carmody sat up. What's the matter? Bellwether asked. Now I can't sleep, Carmody said. Try closing your eyes and consciously relaxing every muscle in your body, starting with the big toe and working upward to... I can't sleep, Carmody shouted. Maybe you weren't very sleepy to begin with, Bellwether suggested. But at least you could close your eyes and try to get a little rest. Won't you do that for me? No, Carmody said. I'm not sleepy and I don't need a rest. Stubborn, Bellwether said. Do what you like. I've tried my best.
Yeah, Carmody said, getting to his feet and walking out of the snoozery.
Carmody stood on a little curved bridge and looked over a blue lagoon.
This is a copy of the Rialto Bridge in Venice, Bellwether said. Scaled down, of course.
I know, Carmody said. I read the sign.
It's rather enchanting, isn't it?
Sure, it's fine, Carmody said, lighting a cigarette.
You're doing a lot of smoking, Bellwether pointed out.
I know. I feel like smoking.
As your medical advisor, I must point out that the link between smoking and lung cancer is conclusive.
I know.
If you switched to a pipe, your chances would be improved.
I don't like pipes.
What about a cigar, then?
I don't like cigars. He lit another cigarette.
That's your third cigarette in 5 minutes, Bellwether said.
God damn it! I'll smoke as much and as often as I please, Carmody shouted.
Well, of course you will, Bellwether said. I was merely trying to advise you for your own good. Would you want me to simply stand by and not say a word while you destroyed yourself?
Yes, Carmody said.
I can't believe you mean that. There is an ethical imperative involved here. Man can act against his best interests, but a machine is not allowed that degree of perversity.
Get off my back, Carmody said sullenly. Quit pushing me around.
Pushing you around? My dear Carmody, have I coerced you in any way? Have I done any more than advise you?
Maybe not, but you talk too much.
Perhaps I don't talk enough, Bellwether said, to judge from the response I get.
You talk too much, Carmody repeated, and lit a cigarette.
That is your fourth cigarette in 5 minutes.
Carmody opened his mouth to bellow an insult. Then he changed his mind and walked away.
What's this? Carmody asked.
It's a candy machine, Bellwether told him.
It doesn't look like one.
Still, it is one. This design is a modification of a design by Sarinaman for a silo. I have miniaturized it, of course, and...
It still doesn't look like a candy machine.
How do you work it?
It's very simple. Push the red button. Now wait. Press down one of those levers on row A. Now press the green button.
There.
A Babe Ruth bar slid into Carmody's hand.
Huh, Carmody said. He stripped off the paper and bit into the bar.
Is this a real Babe Ruth bar or a copy of one? He asked.
It's a real one. I had to subcontract the candy concession because of the pressure of work.
Huh, Carmody said, letting the candy wrapper slip out of his fingers.
That, Bellwether said, is an example of the kind of thoughtlessness I always encounter.
It's just a piece of paper, Carmody said, turning and looking at the candy wrapper lying on the spotless street.
Of course it's just a piece of paper, Bellwether said, but multiply it by 100,000 inhabitants, and what do you have?
100,000 pieces of paper, Carmody answered at once.
I don't consider that funny, Bellwether said. You wouldn't want to live in the midst of all that paper, I can assure you. You'd be the first to complain if this street were strewn with garbage. But do you do your share? Do you even clean up after yourself?
Of course not.
You leave it to me, even though I have to run all the other functions of the city, night and day, without even Sundays off.
Must you go on so? Carmody asked. I'll pick it up.
He bent down to pick up the candy wrapper, but just before his fingers could close on it, a pincer arm shot out of the nearest sewer, snatched the paper away, and vanished from sight.
It's all right, Bellwether said. I'm used to cleaning up after people. I do it all the time.
Yeah, said Carmody.
Nor do I expect any gratitude.
I'm grateful, Carmody said.
No, you're not, Bellwether said.
So, okay, maybe I'm not. What do you want me to say?
I don't want you to say anything, Bellwether said. Let us consider the incident closed.
Had enough, Bellwether said after dinner.
Plenty, Carmody said.
You didn't eat much. I ate all I wanted. It was very good.
If it was so good, why didn't you eat more?
Because I couldn't hold any more.
If you hadn't spoiled your appetite with that candy bar...
God damn it, the candy bar didn't spoil my appetite, I just...
You're lighting a cigarette, Bellwether said.
Yeah, Carmody said.
Couldn't you wait a little longer?
Now look, Carmody said. Just what in hell do you...
But we have something more important to talk about, Bellwether said quickly. Have you thought about what you're going to do for a living?
I haven't really had much time to think about it.
Well, I have been thinking about it. It would be nice if you became a doctor.
Me? I'd have to take special college courses, then get into medical school and so forth.
I can arrange all that, Bellwether said.
Not interested.
Well, what about law?
Never.
Engineering is an excellent line.
Not for me.
What about accounting?
Not on your life.
What do you want to be, then?
A jet pilot, Carmody said impulsively.
Oh, come now.
I'm quite serious.
I don't even have an airfield here.
Then I'll pilot somewhere else.
You're only saying that to spite me.
Not at all, Carmody said. I want to be a pilot. I really do. I've always wanted to be a pilot. Honest, I have.
There was a long silence. Then Bellwether said, "The choice is entirely up to you." This was said in a voice like death. "Where are you going?"
"Out for a walk," Carmody said.
"At 9:30 in the evening?"
"Sure. Why not?"
"I thought you were tired."
"That was some time ago."
"I see. And I also thought that perhaps you could sit here and we could maybe have a nice chat."
"How about if we talk when I get back?" Carmody asked.
"No, it doesn't matter," Bellwether said.
"The walk doesn't matter," Carmody said, sitting down. "Come on, we'll talk."
"I no longer care to talk," Bellwether said. "Please, go for your walk."
"Well, good night," Carmody said.
"I beg your pardon.
I said good night."
"You're going to sleep?"
"Sure, it's late. I'm tired."
"You're going to sleep now, just like that?"
"Well, why not?"
"No reason at all," Bellwether said, "except that you have forgotten to wash."
"Oh, I guess I did forget. I'll wash in the morning."
"How long has it been since you've had a bath?"
"Too long. I'll take one in the morning."
"Wouldn't you feel better if you took one right now?"
"No."
"Even if I drew the bath for you?"
"No, goddammit, no, I'm going to sleep."
"Do exactly as you please," Bellwether said. "Don't wash. Don't study. Don't eat a balanced diet. But also, don't blame me."
"Blame you? For what?"
"For anything," Bellwether said.
"Yes, but what did you have in mind specifically?"
"It isn't important."
"Then why did you bring it up in the first place?"
"I was only thinking of you," Bellwether said.
"I realize that."
"You must know that it can't benefit me if you wash or not."
"I'm aware of that."
"When one cares," Bellwether went on, "when one feels one's responsibilities, it is not nice to hear oneself sworn at."
"I didn't swear at you."
"Not this time. But earlier today, you did."
"Well, I was nervous."
"That's because of the smoking."
"Don't start that again."
"I won't," Bellwether said. "Smoke like a furnace. What does it matter to me? They're your lungs, aren't they?"
"Damned right," Carmody said, lighting a cigarette.
"But my failure," Bellwether said.
"No, no," Carmody said. "Don't say it. Please don't."
"Forget I said it," Bellwether said.
"All right."
"Sometimes I get overzealous."
"Sure.
And it's especially difficult because I'm right. I am right, you know."
"I know," Carmody said. "You're right. You're right. You're always right. Right, 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 right."
"Don't overexcite yourself before bedtime," Bellwether said.
"Would you care for a glass of milk?" No.
You're sure?
Carmody put his hands over his eyes. He felt very strange. He also felt extremely guilty, fragile, dirty, unhealthy, and sloppy. He felt generally and irrevocably bad, and he knew that it would always be this way. From somewhere within him, he found strength. He shouted, "Seathright!" "Who are you shouting to?" Bellwether asked.
"Seathright! Where are you?"
"How have I failed you?" Bellwether asked. "Just tell me how."
"Seathright!" Carmody wailed. "Come and get me! This is the wrong Earth!"
There was a snap, crackle, and pop, and Carmody was somewhere else.